Hello, and welcome to the next segment of Buffalo Who Knew podcast series, which explores the often unearthed, often underappreciated aspects of the great city of Buffalo. And I'm thrilled here to welcome our guest, Craig Steger, who is on the board of the notorious and well-revered Colored Musicians Club. And I'm super excited to learn more about the club. And I'm here, of course, with my compadre, Newell. Hi, Newell.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
So, Craig, welcome. We're really excited to have you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This will be fun.
This will be fun.
Your first podcast.
Yes, first. But I'm not shy, especially since I don't have a camera on here.
And you have a great face for radio.
Yeah, so I do. I've always felt that.
All right, we're off to a good start. So Craig, for those who aren't in Buffalo, which comprise a good portion of our audience, what is the Colored Musicians Club?
Well, the Colored Musicians Club of Buffalo was informally created in 1918, a year after the Black-only Musicians Union was created. That was in 1917. So in 1918, the members of the union decided they should have a musicians club, like almost every other musicians union in the United States, black and white. Members always needed a place to congregate, meet, hang out after shows, and do some networking. So 1918, they informally created it. It was always located in the same building as the local union. And
this was a nationwide movement. This wasn't just in Buffalo.
Yeah, this was everywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. But our as we'll cover a little bit later, our history is very unique in a number of key respects. In 1935, New York State had a mechanism by which you could formally be chartered as a social club. And there were many of them in Buffalo at the time. And the leadership of the union saw great value in incorporating and chartering themselves. Mm-hmm. So in 1935, we chartered ourselves as the Colored Musicians Club of Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. And that gave us a bunch of freedoms that a normal unchartered social club didn't have, including the ability to, it gave us tax benefits as well as an ability to basically police ourselves. We answered only to New York State at that point. We weren't beholden to local authorities. Mm. So we could stay open any hours we wanted to. Mm-hmm. We weren't governed by that.
Could you serve alcohol?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And we served alcohol right from the beginning. And, we had a liquor license, of course, from 1918 forward. But by 1935, we were able to start fundraising for our own benefit, which we couldn't do prior to that.
So I want to dig in a little bit more because, for those who aren't in Buffalo, Buffalo is a very segregated city, has a long, long history of segregation. There's a lot of work to undo that at present. But what was the feeling among the Black community or in the Black community about forming a club that was sort of separated and distinct? And was it were they fully supportive of it? Was it?
Oh yeah, there was no doubt. Right from the very beginning, and I spent a lot of time doing research through our own archives as well as old newspapers. The club started advertising the Black newspapers about its kitchen. The club hired
its kitchen because
they had a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And the public was welcome to come to the restaurant.
And would it have been a predominantly Black clientele, or would white?
It was probably mixed, although it when it did advertise, and it didn't advertise very often, it was advertising the Black newspapers. Mm-hmm. But everybody knew where it was. Mm-hmm. Buffalo's black community was very, very small in the era of the early years of the club.
But this was at a time, though, that there were a lot of like jazz clubs around Buffalo.
They
right?
had just started. Oh,
they had just started.
Yeah, because okay. you know.
So there was a really need for this on a lot of different fronts then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The interest. I mean, we can back up just a little bit. The history of the union. You know, preceded the club technically by about a year. The Buffalo's black musicians, Buffalo was beginning to grow even in the 1910s. The black community in Buffalo was tiny. I mean, in 1910, Buffalo's black community was less than 1,800 people. Mm-hmm. That was 0.4% of Buffalo's population. Mm-hmm. And almost all Buffalo's blacks lived on the east side. There were a handful of them that were down in the Canal District at that time. Mm-hmm. But it was a hard life for them, you know, mm-hmm. Race relations being what they were.
And they were coming up to work in industry and yeah. in Buffalo.
But
and
to a very limited extent. I mm-hmm. mean, there were two phases of the Great Migration, which succeeded both world wars. Mm-hmm. We didn't have much of an influx of black people seeking employment and escaping the South mm-hmm. until after World War II. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I said our Buffalo's black population was 1,800 in 1910. In 1920, it was 4,500. It took a big jump right after World War II. Mm-hmm. That's when Bethlehem Steel was expanding, and there were many more opportunities up here for employment. Mm-hmm. The factories had popped up all over Western New York.
So you have this culture of jazz. You've got this growing movement, but it sounds like it was also somewhat of a community center from the beginning.
Oh, and that's one of the very unique features about our club. The same might be said for some of the other black musicians' clubs in the country. They were everywhere. Mm-hmm. Virtually every city that had a union had a musicians' club, including the black unions.
And they were always called the Colored Musicians Club. Was there a national association of the club?
No, club? There wasn't. But you know that was the approved term at that mm-hmm. point in time. Mm-hmm. We chose to keep that name because that's part of our charter and that's part of our heritage. Mm-hmm. We're frequently calling ourselves the Historic Colored Musicians Club now, just so mm-hmm. people understand that this is a context type of thing. It's not just a bunch of people stuck in the past. We respect their decision to name themselves as such. Mm-hmm. And we've kept that name continuously since 35. But the black musicians of Buffalo in starting around 1914 tried to join the whites union. There was extreme segregation of unions everywhere at that point, including musicians, and they kept getting turned down. Mm. 1916, so 2 years later, one of our founders of our union and the club was a black vaudeville star named Jesse Clipper. Hmm. And he'd been on the circuit nationwide. He was actually quite famous. My wife and I.
I'm a little confused by that. Jesse was a vaudeville performer.
He was a black. There were two types of vaudeville, of course. There was a white vaudeville and a black vaudeville. He was a star in black vaudeville.
Okay.
And spent his life from early on. I think he was apprenticed when he was like 10 or 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And he just did the circuit, just town after town after town after town, just moved all over the country. He moved to Buffalo around 1916. After multiple years of the black musicians here trying to get accepted into the white union, which was possible back then, but the white union didn't want to have any part of it. Mm. Right after Jesse arrived, he had enormous connections in the music industry. He'd been in the music industry his whole life. At least he was in his 30s at that point. He'd been in the music industry for 20 years already at that point in his life.
He was obviously a musician himself.
Oh, yes.
So what did he play?
He did everything.
He did everything?
He was the modern-day equivalent of like a Sammy Davis Jr. And we've got newspaper reviews of his shows. He was a comedian. He could act. He played drums. He played trombone. He was extremely popular with audiences. We've got numerous reviews from newspapers, black and white, just talking about what a marvelous performer.
Is he interred at Forest Lawn?
No, he's buried in France.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he got to Buffalo around 1916, and we don't have any documents to this effect, but we know what happened. He picked up the, well, not a phone. There weren't any phones back then. He telegraphed somebody in New York City where he had just come from and said, there's a whole bunch of very talented musicians up here that can't join the white union. What are our options? And he was told, you can tell the musicians in Buffalo they could either form, and this was available to any black musicians in the country that wanted to unionize, they could either become a subsidiary black union under the American Federation of Musicians, or they could become a standalone black union under the AFM. Subsidiaries were completely controlled by the white unions. The standalones, you're a member of the AFM, but you got to pay your union dues to us. You got to follow all the rules, and you're on your own financially. If you make a mistake and you can't handle the circumstances, you're done, and no one's going to come to your rescue. The Buffalo musicians were the eighth group in the United States to opt for the standalone.
Now
they've got a union. Now they're instantly competing with the white union, exactly. Which is 10 times the size and had been in existence for about 30 years at that point. So this is 1917. The Black Musicians Union in Buffalo was formed. It was union number 533. It must have been a very interesting period. We've got some documents in our files about this, but they had to work out a governance arrangement for the territory. Their initial arrangement was they would decide when an out-of-town band of musicians or entertainers would come to Buffalo, who's going to contract? Who are they going to contract with? They're going to contract with the white union or the black union? So the initial decisions were based on the racial nature of the band.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So they did that for a couple of years, and then they decided for whatever reason or reasons that didn't work. So then they decided, all right, the only other way to govern the territory mutually is to just designate specific clubs, a black club or a white club.
So was there a white musicians club?
There weren't many areas that could be called suburbs at that point, but they tended to be on the other side of Main Street and some toward the north towns.
Okay.
There were a few up in the Kenmore and Niagara Falls had its own musicians union. They never had a black union up there. Niagara Falls had a white union. So there was a dividing line somewhere between Buffalo and Niagara Falls. Ultimately, that ended up creating an enormous nightclub scene in Buffalo because it was the beginning of the jazz age. It was right on the eve of Prohibition when all the speakeasies popped up, and everybody wanted to dance to and listen to the black music anyway. So instantly, the black union, 533, owned the East Side.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And because Buffalo's blacks musicians also lived over there, it was very easy for them to get gigs over there, and it spawned an enormous growth of nightclubs and hotels with dance halls in it. And fundamentally, Buffalo ended up being considered part of the Chitlin' Circuit, which very few people are aware of.
So let's talk about that. What is the Chitlin'
Circuit? The Chitlin' Circuit was a network of cities that had black nightclubs and and supported black music.
So what other cities?
Memphis, New Orleans, Chicago,
Cleveland,
Detroit, Pittsburgh. We were in the middle of all of them, and Buffalo was a railroad hub, so it was natural for us to be included on that, which, of course, continued to foster the development of nightclubs. Hmm. One of the other interesting things that helped the growth of the Buffalo Union 533 was never very large. I mean, I've created databases of the membership. At most, it had 125 members. Hmm. That's not to say there weren't more black musicians that could have been in the union, but we had different standards than the white union did. In order to join the black, in order to join our black union, 533, you had to be able to sight read music, you had to pass an audition. And you had to prove that you could play in an ensemble. The white union had none of those requirements. So our union, our members, and this is just visionary on the part of our leadership, were better than the white musicians because they had to perform at a higher standard. They had to have a greater level of musicianship.
So even traveling musicians that were coming to Buffalo, some of the bigger names, they would have to fall under the same qualifications?
Well, no, we couldn't impose our standards on them, but because we had those standards and that extremely high level of musicianship, when the nature of the beast is, even at the height of the swing era, let's just pick an example, Duke Ellington, who was royalty in jazz, he could rarely afford to bring all members of his band on tour. I mean, he had his own Pullman cars. Ultimately, he had his own buses, too. He couldn't afford that. So he would take the key musicians from his band with him, and then they would go to town and go to the Union Hall and look for a trombone player, gotcha. You know, whatever, yeah. What have you. We lost members of our union to bands like that because they recognized very early on, they don't have to audition these guys. They go to the Union Hall and they say, we need the following musicians. They give them a list of people. They say, we'll take them because we know we're just going to be able to put them right up on the bandstand and they're ready to go.
Yep.
And then ultimately, some of them got swept away.
Right. Yeah.
So this is
good problem to have.
Yeah. This foundation is amazing, and I really appreciate the history. So let's look at the subsequent, you know, rest of the 20th century. Talk to us about what happened to the Colored Musicians Club.
Okay. Well, the unions were the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. It mandated desegregation, especially in unions, you know, in other places as well. The white and black unions in the United States, musicians' unions, started to merge starting in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. The leaders of our union / club recognized that I got to get my feet off the squeaky. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear that. They recognize
it's not an instrument.
It's not an instrument.
No, I'm not playing anything. They recognize that a merger was going to be bad for their members, mm-hmm. because their members were going to get swallowed up by the white union. They were going to lose their livelihoods. And so the black union in Buffalo, Union 533, was one of the last ones in the United States to merge. They resisted until they were forced to. And so they merged with the white union in 1969. And they formed a new union with a new number. And sure enough, exactly what they feared was going to happen. Suddenly, their members are less than a tenth of the merged union, and people lost their jobs. Mm. They didn't get selected for gigs anymore. And But, you know, our people held out as long as they possibly could, but then they had no alternatives. But along the way, the reason the club is still here is because they recognized in the 1920s, you know, 40-plus years before the unions were forced to merge, our leadership recognized that we needed to be keep the union and club's finances separate. They needed to manage their finances very rigorously. And we rented the building where the club currently is at 145 Broadway for 10 years. Over that 10-year time span, we conducted fundraisers. We banked every penny. We've got the financial records. There wasn't a penny spent or a penny of income that wasn't accounted for. Mm. And when the building was offered to us for sale in 1943, we ended up buying it in 1944. Mm. The club bought it. And it's subleased to the union. So lo and behold, fast forward to 1969, the day after the merger agreement was ratified and signed and whatever, the story goes that the officers of the combined union, the white fellows, came down to 145 Broadway, and they were just going to scope out where they were going to put their offices, and they were turned back because the building didn't belong to the union that they just absorbed. It belonged to the club.
Wow, how awesome is that?
Yep. That is so phenomenal. Yep. Talk about visionary.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they recognized that 40 years before anyone even thought that the unions were actually going to have to merge.
Yeah.
Well, and I think
So that's why we're the only black musicians club surviving in the United States. There's one in New York City that's technically a little bit older, but they've changed their mission. They ceased operations for a period of time, and they moved around a bunch. Mm. We've always been at 145 Broadway, and then
which for people who aren't in Buffalo, I think it's important to point out that this is now recognized as the African American Heritage Corridor,
yes.
And you've got a number of co-located nonprofits, cultural institutions, etc. So Little Harlem had been there before that building was torn down, which was a notorious, what was it, an inn and music venue also?
Yeah, it was a nightclub and hotel. Mm. Actually originated as an ice cream parlor. Mm. And I've done a bunch of research on that. It was one of the first establishments in the United States that had floor shows with costume changes and a pit orchestra. Hmm. It was basically Las Vegas 20 years before Las Vegas was invented.
I mean, I'm not a fan of trying to rebuild buildings because we just invariably cannot do it as well as we did the first time around. Yeah. But I'd be supportive in that case to rebuild a Little Harlem. Gosh. I mean,
and there is no doubt that they could have been on the National Register of Historic Places. Mm. The club is, the Michigan Street Baptist Church is, yeah. And the Nash House, which is the home of the pastor of the church, mm-hmm. was. And there were a couple other sites that could have also been on the National. I've called it in the reports I've written the most historic four-block neighborhood in Black American history.
Amazing.
And it's right in the middle of the city, and people are just beginning to appreciate it.
That's right. Yeah. And I've seen
now if we could get some traffic calming.
Well, exactly. there's absolutely some streetscape work that's needed. But there is, I have seen some tourism pieces from Visit Buffalo Niagara, our tourist bureau, yeah. And there is a targeted marketing going out into the national, international audience to say, just as you're saying, like, this is an incredibly important site. But how amazing. Buffalo held onto its, it is the only one in the country. So what does that give Buffalo? What, in the music world, does that give us some cred? I mean,
it certainly does. We were, the way unions worked, I think they may still work this way in modern times, is when unions were located in major cities. The city, those unions had control over that territory. When a band, let's just take another example. When Count Basie would travel, say, to Buffalo, in order to perform here, he and his bandmates had to become temporary members of the local union. The only way they could do that was by surrendering their union card from their hometown. Mm-hmm. That guaranteed that they were going to come back to that business office at the end of their gig and pay their dues. Yep. Because they wanted their cards back. If they lost their cards, they'd be reported to the national office, and then all kinds of trouble would ensue. So in Buffalo's case, just like any other city, Basie comes to town. Basie becomes a temporary member of Local 533, along with all of his bandmates. There were very few Buffalo black hotels in Buffalo at the time. I mean, this was a sad period in our history where a lot of cases when the musicians would play in a hotel, they couldn't stay in that hotel. Mm. They'd have to come in through the back door to get up on stage so people could dance to them. And then they'd have to leave through the back door. And then where are they going to stay? If they were a rich band like Basie or Ellington were, they'd have a Pullman railroad car, or they'd have a bus. But mostly, or, you know, go to the few black hotels in town, and Buffalo only had a couple of them. Or they'd go back to the Union Hall. Get their cards back so they could, you know, leave town the next morning. They've already got their instruments with them, and they're looking for a place to stay. A lot of times they stayed with Buffalo musicians. While you're here, the kitchen's open, the bar's open, and you got your instruments here, and here's a bunch of guys you may or may not have played with. How about a gig? Let's do a jam session. Everybody in town knew that those bands were going to come back to the to 145 Broadway at the end of their shows, and the place couldn't hold many people. It's a small building. The capacity is less than 100. But people would, if they couldn't afford to go to the show, they'd stand in line outside the building waiting to get in, because they knew they would at least get a chance to meet these famous guys, if not actually hear them perform in a more relaxed setting.
Yeah. Amazing. Which leads me to think that I would love to see like photographs of this time, and there is a historic museum element at the club, right?
Yeah, we've got a museum on the first floor. It's being refreshed as we speak. It's going to open sometime early next year. The first museum opened in 2012. And then between construction and the pandemic, it's been closed for quite a while.
It's a pretty interactive museum too.
Yeah, and it's going to be much more interactive this time
out. And is it a lot of ephemera from different eras?
Not as much of that. It's more educational, but we do have some elements on display. And we're always seeking more. I mean, one of the things.
Is there a lot of live footage from?
I wish. Yeah. We really don't have anything. The new club, is being completely redone. I was just up there a couple of weeks ago. Modern stage, modern electronics, lighting.
Not just redone, but expanded.
Well, expanded in the sense that we've got an addition on the building, but the club is still the same because we're landlocked.
Right.
It's a historic building. It was built in 1910, so we can't add anything onto it. We're restricted in terms of what we can do. But the original bar from 1935 is being redone. You know, it's being restored. But we're also putting in sound and lighting equipment, and we are preparing for live streaming as well as recording sessions.
Yeah, what about the grounds? Because I know that you have the annual festival there. So are the grounds also being kind of developed to be conducive to outdoor?
Yes, they are. We're planning stages outside the building on either side. Excuse me.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And just to have more festivals, exactly. As is the Michigan Street Commission. They're talking, although they may have changed their mind once they heard our plans, they're planning on putting a stage in that gigantic parking lot right next to the commission offices.
Oh, wow. At Broadway, I'm not Michigan. Aware of that. Yeah.
They've already got a farmer's market,
yep.
And a whole bunch of other activities.
That's right.
Just to become central to the community, like it was way back when.
That was going to be a question that I had. Is it, what sort of co-programming or cross-pollinating are the disparate organizations doing in that corridor?
Well, we've got lots of great ideas, but everyone's pretty much focused on just trying to get their buildings back mm-hmm. up in order. I mean, the church and the Nash House have undergone some renovations, not as extensive as ours. WUFO radio station.
The new development just opened. The what is it? The Nash Lofts, is it called?
Yeah.
On the corner?
Yeah, so, right at the corner of Michigan.
So for those not in Buffalo, it's a beautiful, you know, late 19th century building that has been converted to mixed use. And I had understood that the first floor was going to be a jazz club. Is that?
Believe so. I know the local chapter of the NAACP is located there.
Oh, great.
Okay. Which is, of course, extremely appropriate.
Yeah.
And as you were saying before, WUFO.
Oh, yeah. WUFO is going to move to a building that is currently an old building that's being renovated and expanded that's immediately next to the Michigan Street Baptist Church.
And WUFO is?
WUFO. It's one of the oldest black-owned radio stations in the country. And it's very historic in its own right. They've got a small museum of their own, which they hope to expand. So they will move next to the church, and the club is going to expand into the space where the radio station is.
So what's happening with all the programming now that the space is being worked on? Are you, are you going in other venues? Are you doing events in other venues?
We will do some joint programming with other music halls and such. In
the History
town.
Museum.
Oh, yeah. And we've been working at the History Museum once a month. We moved our jam. Well, it started out moving our jam sessions there. Now we've got actually bands coming into play just to keep ourselves in the public eye, because it's just been so long mm-hmm. since there's been any kind of activity. But our events coordinator has 6 months worth of jazz programming already lined up. You can't really commit to anything yet because we don't know exactly when we're going to get the keys to the building. But it's going to be glorious space. I mean, we've raised the ceiling, we've soundproofed. So that club space from 1935 to the present has had just unbelievable amount of people just stopping in or performing, either because their bands were in town or because they were in town performing elsewhere and they always wanted to see what this place was like.
Yeah, and what I also love about it is the cross-generational aspect of it. I've been there before where you see some of the real young players playing with some of the well-seasoned players, and I always think that's really fantastic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's one of our missions. It actually goes back to our charter in 35 was education, because mm-hmm. We recognize that, well, especially now that, you know, music programs have been gutted almost everywhere, especially in public schools, unless the parents can afford private lessons, these kids have no way of learning unless they're extremely gifted and they can just pick it up on their own.
Right.
So how can people get involved? So let's talk about ways in which our listeners could support the CMC. It sounds like you can be a member.
Yes, there's memberships available at different levels. You know, we're going to start a docents program. We're hoping to collaborate with some local colleges and universities because we can always use more hands. We want to keep the museum open, expanded hours. And it'll be necessary once it's open because people will rush to us. We're getting bombarded with calls all the time, when can I come?
Please, yeah, that's great.
Please let me know what's happening. I miss you guys.
Yep.
So those are two opportunities right there.
You're a 501c3, so yep. I assume that people can donate.
We certainly are. We can certainly take donations. The other thing, we're going to make a continual campaign of is to try to recover parts of our history. I mean, Buffalo is loaded with family members of people who belong to the Union or members of the club early on, and they have artifacts. They've got stories. They've got photographs. We have some, but we always could use more. And we will set up mechanisms such that we can digitize them and give proper credit to the families that shared these with us. Or if they want to donate them to us, we will put them in secure storage and then have them available to people in the community or researchers that want to learn more about our history.
Great. Well, so before we conclude, I know, and the theme of this podcast is Buffalo Who Knew, which is to highlight aspects of the city that we don't necessarily know about or are unearthed or under-recognized. And we've heard a bunch of factoids from you today. You're a wealth of knowledge. Is there anything you can think of in the club's history that or in the present day that people just don't know much about?
Well, I think that one of the things that's underappreciated is how our union and our club had a community focus from the very beginning. This wasn't just a way for people to make a living. And a couple of examples are, and this, I don't believe this was done by the White Union in the same time period, but as an example, 2 years after we were created, which is 1919, the union set up an emergency fund with monies to help people pay to bury their loved ones in case they died prematurely. Prior to that, they had to have fundraisers or pass the hat, and people didn't get a proper burial, didn't get proper acknowledgement. We had constant fundraisers for our for members that are down on their luck, where the band would show up. We had community parades. We had we celebrated holidays in the community with Easter egg hunts and things like that. Our union formed a credit union in 1940.
Wow.
This was an era where black people couldn't get loans to buy houses or cars. They could go and get a loan from the union, and they could sustain themselves and live the American dream. I don't know how many other black unions did such a thing, but we did.
Amazing.
It's truly fantastic.
Incredible. So, Craig, I can't thank you enough. This has been incredibly eye-opening. You really are an incredible historian, and it's wonderful that you're involved with this fantastic institution. We look forward to the reopening. We look forward to coming and hearing some music, and all the best to you and everyone working on this.
Oh, thanks, and I'd be happy to come back again at some point if you want me to extend that.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. All right,
thanks very much.
All right.